From listener-supported Capital Public Radio, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, we'll talk with a Yolo County man who's helping to redraw California's political boundaries. He's Stan Forbes, a member of the Citizens Redistricting Commission. Also, a Sacramento Sikh who wants to work as a prison guard but refuses to shave off his beard. The Corrections Department requires its guards to be clean-shaven. But first, we continue Brown's Countdown, our series on the California budget, a collaboration with the Sacramento Bee. Tonight, Governor Jerry Brown will take his budget plans directly to the public in his first State of the State address, at least his first in the century. Brown, of course, also gave State of the State addresses when he was governor in the late 70s and early 80s. The governor is dealing with a $25 billion deficit, and he's proposing to cover about half of that with budget cuts and the rest with tax extensions, which would require a special election in June. If the extensions don't make it onto the ballot or voters turn them down, Brown says more budget cuts would be needed. How is Brown doing so far in dealing with the deficit? What does he need to achieve tonight? And what are the prospects for Brown getting what he wants? Joining us with analysis is Dan Moraine, senior editor of the Sacramento Bee editorial pages. Dan, welcome back to Insight.
Good to be here, Jeffrey.
Well, let's start with how Governor Brown is doing so far in the initial salvos when it comes to the budget. He laid out his proposed budget, and it has a lot of tough things in it. How is he doing so far politically?
Well, I think politically he's doing well, but this is the honeymoon period. He is doing many of the things that he ought to be doing, cutting cell phones. And on Friday, he announced he's going to take back a bunch of state cars. So he's doing cost-cutting moves that in a, you know, an $85 billion budget don't add up to a huge amount, but symbolically, they're very important.
Do you think he's doing those symbolic cuts because of a political calculation that the voters are more likely to extend taxes because of that sort of thing? Or is it more because it really speaks to who Jerry Brown actually is, because he's famously frugal?
Well, he is. But these are things that voters get very upset about. I mean, how many people have a car at their disposal or a cell phone that their company pays for? I mean, these are things that you and I, you know, pay for, and the fact that he is figuring out ways to make a point that the state has to fundamentally restructure, I think it's very smart politically, and it also is who he is. I mean, this is a guy who's driving not one of these big old SUVs and in a big caravan. He's got a 2008 Pontiac.
Yes, quite the blue Plymouth, but still,
it's a Pontiac.
Yeah. My guest is Dan Moraine of the Sacramento Bee editorial pages. What do you think Democrats are making of Governor Brown? Public unions spent quite a lot of money to help him get elected because they favored him over Meg Whitman, the Republican who was running for governor. But still, Governor Brown has proposed cutting many billions of dollars out of the state budget, and he's definitely open to cutting $25 billion out of the state budget if voters don't approve tax increases. Do you think Democratic interest groups might be disappointed?
Well, I think they think it would have been much worse had Meg Whitman won.
Because it would definitely be all $25 billion in cuts.
Well, I think that the reality of $25 billion in cuts out of an $85 billion general fund I guess I have a hard time imagining that Californians truly would want that. I mean, you can't do this by cutting cell phones and cars. You do this by closing campuses of CSU or UC and releasing a lot of prisoners and these sorts of things, putting people off welfare, of course. But I think when people think about the reality of that, I think they might think twice. I don't know. That said, I think public employee unions, union leaders understand that it could be worse, and that if this ballot measure goes down, it will be worse. Beyond that, I think that they have a fundamental trust for Jerry Brown. I mean, Brown is, after all, the guy who signed the legislation in his first term that gave them collective bargaining rights. So they have a fundamental trust that he is not going to go out of his way to make their lives more difficult.
Well, tonight, Governor Brown gives a State of the State address. It's relatively late in January. Oftentimes, the State of the State address comes early in the month. Don't know why he's delayed it. But what do you think? How important do you think this is for the governor? I read at the weekend a quote attributed to one of his advisors, Stephen Glazer, who basically said, what's the difference between a bunch of TV cameras watching Jerry Brown talk to the LA County Board of Supervisors and Governor Brown talking to the lawmakers at the state capitol? Seemed to be downplaying the significance of the State of the State address. What do you think? Is it a big deal or not?
Well, sure, it's a big deal. And you're right, it is late in the month. Usually governors or presidents give their states of the state or union speeches before they release the budget. This time, Brown released his budget and now is putting out his State of the State speech. Yes, it's an important talk because it'll get statewide coverage. It will have greater sweep than if he were to speak to the Board of Supervisors in L.A. County, as important as the L.A. County vote is. Now, this is, of course, it's a big deal. And he's going to talk about the budget. He has to talk about the budget. He has to talk about the right to vote on the tax measure. We don't know exactly what this tax measure is going to say because it hadn't been written yet. But he's going to have to figure out a way to get the public behind voting for this tax, whether they want to extend these so-called temporary taxes.
So in a way, it's almost like an opening salvo in the June special election, if there is one.
Oh, absolutely. He wants to get a two-thirds vote. He wants to get Republicans to support this measure. That's a big deal for him.
Isn't the governor in this sort of like that? Those acrobats or jugglers, rather, who got this plate spinning on all these poles, and you have to run around and keep them spinning. I mean, on the one hand, he's trying to keep the voters spinning to hopefully persuade them, in his mind, hopefully persuade them to approve a tax extension. But he also has other plates spinning, the Democrats in the legislature and the Republicans, because the Democrats need to sign off on these big spending cuts as part of an overall package. Do you think they're going to go along with them?
Well, the Democrats... not every Democrat's going to vote for these spending cuts. He will need Republican votes to get if he's going to get very serious about abolishing or significantly restructuring redevelopment, for example. That's a $1.7 billion bite out of this budget. Republicans will support that. Far more Republicans will support that than Democrats, I think. But he's got to get it to the floor, and that's a big deal. And it will only go to the floor if the Democratic leaders in the Assembly and Senate agree that it should go to the floor. So he's got to get, you know, he's going to have to talk about the right to vote that you know, for something like redevelopment, he's going to want to get this to the floor. For something like the tax extensions, he's going to want to get that before the electorate, and he's going to need Democrats and Republicans to support that.
Yeah, and getting Republicans to support putting the tax extension measure on the ballot could be a big challenge in itself, because the Republicans are under a lot of pressure from anti-tax folks, most notably Grover Norquist, to not even put it on the ballot, let alone vote for it.
Yeah, it is... Yes, that's very true. It's not just Grover Norquist, who's this fellow out of Virginia and Washington, D.C., sort of a creature of the Beltway, but it's John Kapal of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association here in Sacramento, and John Fleischman, who's a influential blogger and officer in the California Republican Party, who are adamantly opposed to putting this to a vote of the people. So yeah, the Republicans, there's a barrier here. You know, it's kind of interesting. So far, though, the people are a little more optimistic about the state of the state. The poll put out last week by the Public Policy Institute of California this is, I suppose, a very small thing. But the percentage of California voters who think the state's going in the right direction is now 35%. Not very good, except for that it was 17% back in last January.
17%. That's right. Pretty dismal.
Right. So it's, you know, it's inching up. Now Brown has approval rating of 46%. Not hasn't broken the 50% mark, but only 19% are disapproving of him right now. So of registered voters. So he's, you know, he's doing a little bit better than his predecessor.
One thing that must be in the back of the minds of Democratic lawmakers is the possibility that they could reluctantly agree to many billions of dollars worth of spending cuts as part of the budget deal. But then the tax extensions either don't make it onto the June ballot or they do make it onto the June ballot and voters say no, in which case there'll be basically no option but to fill the rest of the budget gap with more cuts.
Yeah. Well, that certainly seems to be the you know, it's an up or down vote. So I think you're right. I think your analysis is correct. It's kind of interesting, though. One of the things that Brown has not done is talk about what those cuts would look like if you have to double, which is what he would do. Right now, it's $12.5 billion in cuts. If he had to double that and make it a $25 billion cut budget, what would that look like? He hasn't really laid that out. Certainly, he knows he's got in mind what he would cut, but that's, you know, then you're talking real crisis mode, and I'm not sure you would get Democrats to support a $25 billion tax or spending cut. I mean, I just think that you close campuses, you release a bunch of prisoners, which no politician wants to do. You abolish welfare, these sorts of things. It's a tough vote.
Well, there's a lot to happen between now and then if that comes about. But we are living in interesting times, and you'll hear those interesting times, at least a segment of them, this evening at 5 o'clock with our live coverage of Governor Brown's State of the State Address here on Capital Public Radio. In the meantime, Dan Moraine, Senior Editor of the Sacramento Bee Editorial Pages, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, you're welcome.
And that discussion was part of Brown's Countdown, a series on the state budget and a collaboration between Capital Public Radio and the Sacramento Bee. You'll find previous segments and stories at capradio.org and sacbee.com. This is Insight from listener-supported Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. California's political boundaries are about to be redrawn thanks to the new population numbers from the census. This work is a big deal, and it could affect the political balance in Sacramento and Washington. Previous redistricting was done by lawmakers, but critics call that a conflict of interest. In 2008, California voters approved the creation of a Citizens Commission to handle this decade's redistricting. And that commission is now getting up to speed. One of the commission's members lives in Yolo County near Davis. He's Stan Forbes, who is, among other things, a co-owner of the Avid Reader Bookstores. Stan Forbes, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Appreciate your opportunity to be here.
And we should point out that there are certain things that legally you're not allowed to talk about outside of the context of a public meeting, specifically the details of redistricting decision-making.
That's correct. I mean, that was in the Prop 11, and we try to adhere to that very closely.
Okay. This sounds like a lot of work. The work of the Citizens Redistricting Commission, and it's not a full-time job. Why did you decide to sign up for it?
Well, I think that it was an opportunity for public service in a way that it's no secret that a lot of people feel that California politics governance has major problems. And this was one of the mechanisms that the public has decided to introduce to help address those problems. And so, and I've always been involved in public service. I mean, for decades. And so, this was an opportunity to bring some skills. I thought, and I was really pleased to be selected. Truthfully,
yes. What was your position on the ballot measure that created this? Did you vote for or against?
Oh, I absolutely voted for it. And then this last November, I voted also for Prop 20 and against Prop 27.
Did you think it was a problem that lawmakers drew their own district boundaries?
I personally did, and the measure itself makes that specific finding that it's a conflict of interest.
Yes.
In fact, there's one line in the ballot proposal or in the ballot measure that talks about how It used to be that the politicians selected their voters rather than the voters selected the politicians, and then this was designed to redress that.
When the commission was being formed, it was quite a lengthy process.
Mm-hmm.
And early in the process, critics said, and it seemed from the outside with some reason, that there was a fairly limited segment of California's population was applying to be members of the commission, that it was heavily skewed in favor of older people, white people, and men. How does the commission look today? Does it reflect California?
Well, I think it does. First of all, I mean, I think from my recollection, and I was only as a member of the public, that was true. But then the auditor's office did a wonderful job in outreach. And so something like 36,000 people ultimately applied for these positions. As we ended up, some of us luck at the draw, the first eight, after having gone through all the process and gotten to the final 36, the first eight were drawn randomly. But right now we have three Anglos, three Hispanics, four Asians, two African Americans, one Native American, and one Pacific Islander. So it's really quite a potpourri of California, I think.
Why do you think you made the cut? Was there anything in your background that you know or suspect was a reason why you made it to that final 36 and then ultimately to the commission?
Well, actually, no. I mean, I have, a track record. I was on the Davis School Board for 10 years. I was on the Davis City Council for 4 years. I wrote a political column for the Davis Enterprise for 3 or 4 years. So I have a legal background. I'm a farmer. I'm small business. So there's a variety of things like that. But I don't think that makes me particularly unique. The criteria that they specifically wanted, they wanted people who they thought would be impartial, and they had the relevant analytical skills. Those are the things they were really looking for to get down to the final 36. And the way the process worked is that after they filtered through. We got down to 120. We all were interviewed, and then they recommended 6 to the legislature, and the legislature cut 24.
My guest is Stan Forbes. He's a member of California Citizens Redistricting Commission. He lives near Davis and is co-owner of the Avid Reader Bookstores in Davis and Sacramento. How confident can people be that you and the other commission members actually will be impartial?
Oh, I think we are. It's remarkable. Initiative made the point of being sure this was everybody's representative. So there's 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, and 4 declined to state.
You're one of them.
I'm one of the declined to state. That's correct. And we have a voting process to adopt the maps where you have to have at least 3 votes from each group. But in fact, I would say this is about as nonpartisan a group as you're ever going to run into. And I think it's because of what we're trying to do here. I mean, the whole purpose of why we're engaged in this.
You're saying that even the commission members who are registered Democrats or Republicans are acting in your, as far as you're concerned, in a nonpartisan way.
That's right. We have a remarkable rapport and remarkable amount of open-mindedness and nonpartisanship.
What about lawmakers? Are you in contact with lawmakers? Are you allowed to be in contact with lawmakers?
None whatsoever. They may not contact us, and I could read you out of the initiative, but in short, we can't talk to any lawmakers or any of their staffs. And in fact, all of our deliberations have to be done in public. At public meetings regarding any of the matters of substance.
Another criticism of handing over redistricting to citizens or just of taking them away from lawmakers is that society gives lawmakers the ability to make decisions on the biggest matters imaginable. Why not extend this to them? I mean, if we trust lawmakers in Washington to take us into or out of war, and we trust lawmakers in Sacramento to make big decisions about education, health and welfare, prisons and so on, why not political districts too?
Well, I speculate, but I also take from the language of the initiative that in those issues, I guess, the public feels that they don't have a particular conflict of interest. But in this case, because they're drawing their own districts, they would have that conflict of interest. And that's just the difference. And in the public's judgment, they just think it's too great an enticement to manipulate the system. And that's been the case. I mean, the term gerrymander goes way back into the early 19th century, where districts were drawn to benefit some politicians at the expense of others.
One other question about political affiliation. As we said, you're one of 4 board members in the decline to state or other category. But didn't you used to be a registered Republican?
Yes, I did until the year 2000.
And why did you stop being a registered Republican?
Well, truthfully, George Bush got me to change. I mean, my brand of being a Republican was being socially liberal, fiscally conservative, and internationally cautious. The Republican Party had become, in my judgment, fiscally not conservative, socially very conservative, and internationally adventuresome. And that's just not where I was. So I felt obligated to change.
But couldn't outsiders then think, well, Stan, he's officially declined a state, but he's really a Republican. He should be in the Republican camp on the commission.
Well, I mean, I would be happy to explain my brand of being a Republican, which is no longer where the party is.
Where about in the process is the commission? I mean, are you at the point yet of looking at population numbers and actual boundaries of districts?
No. What we spent the last December was largely done to pick the six members, because the way the thing was set up, the first eight had to pick the next six. And then January has been largely a housekeeping thing. We had to basically create an state agency. So we've had to hire an executive director. We've had to hire a general counsel. We've had to just get the mechanics of the process going. We won't see the numbers until at least the middle of March. Typically, it's been the end of March, but we were told this last week in a meeting that the Census Bureau is going to get the numbers to us closer to the middle of March.
Speaking of housekeeping and setting up basically a temporary small state agency, I read the other day on Twitter, Joe Matthews, the political journalist and author and a fellow at the New America Foundation, he asked, why is a communications director needed at the Citizens Redistricting Commission? Can you address that?
Well, I think that being part of our goal here is to have outreach. That's a very important part of this whole process. If you read the initiative, at every opportunity, the public is supposed to have the opportunity to be involved. We're streamed live on the web. Our meetings are transcribed, that's all put up on the web. All the communications are put up on the web. Our applications were up on the web. This has been a very, very open process. And I think that the purpose of the information staff member will be to continue that process. And it's really a two-way street here. To some degree, we have to provide education to the public as to what their role is, how they can participate in this whole process, because this is about them. It's not about us. It's about the public and getting them involved so that they're committed and they believe that this system has been fair. And so that's the role of this person.
Now, I realize we could talk at great length about what guidelines will govern the actual drawing up of new districts, but give us some idea of the kinds of things that you'll be keeping in mind, the commission will be keeping in mind to do or not do when it's redrawing political boundaries in California.
Well, again, I'm going to be cautious about what I say here because we can't talk about redistricting matters, but I can take it right out of the initiative. I mean, one of the complaints of the previous process was that communities of interest cities were broken up into multiple districts, according to the initiative, to meet the needs of legislators rather than the needs of the public. So, I mean, the initiative has a number of standards, one of which is that, to the extent possible, they need to be contiguous, they need to be compact, they have to have roughly the same level of population. Of course, we have to comply with the Voting Rights Act. Those sorts of things are things that we will have to take into account. But those are all listed in the initiative.
Sounds like a lot of juggling, and in some cases, that may these things might be mutually exclusive.
Well, that's one reason why we're going to be needing the public input so we can make judgments on where these things are, would apparently be in conflict or could be in conflict. We have the public's input to see how they want it done.
And then what's the end result of this? The commission will come up with these maps, these new political district maps for California, for the state legislature and for the congressional seats. Mm-hmm. What happens to those maps?
Well, after they have been, they will be the ones. We have to be done with our work by August 1st because the maps must be approved by August 15th. And the public gets 14 days by the initiative to comment on the maps before we take a final vote, which would be the August 15th vote. And then they're used for the 2012 election.
That's it. The commission is the final word on
that. That's it. I mean, the people can always take us to court, but as far as the maps themselves, we're the final word.
And you will be, at least in principle, listening to what the public has to say when they cast their opinions on what the commission's doing.
Well, it's more than in principle. The whole process is designed to elicit the public's comments. What are their community of interests? How do they want to see these things drawn? That's the whole purpose that we have, what we're about. I mean, if you read the ordinance or the initiative, you'll see that there's a great sense that the public in the past has been really cut out of the process. And the purpose of this is to ensure that the public actually is at the very forefront of this process and drawing the new lines.
Stan Forbes, he's a member of California Citizens Redistricting Commission. He lives near Davis, is also co-owner of the Avid Reader Bookstores in Davis and Sacramento. Stan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
This is Insight on listener-supported Capital Public Radio. When we come back, a fulsome Sikh who wants to work as a prison guard but refuses to shave off his beard. This is Insight from listener-supported Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow, reaction to Governor Brown's State of the State address. Also, a debate on redevelopment agencies. Are they a valuable tool for creating jobs and regenerating blighted areas, or a waste of state money? You'll hear arguments from both sides. A fulsome man who's a Sikh says the state of California is violating his civil rights. Trilocean Oberoi wants to be a prison guard but can't because the corrections department requires him to shave off his beard so that it fits fully inside a gas mask. But Oberoi is required by his religion to wear a beard, and he's taken California to court. I talked with him the other day and asked Trilocean Oberoi why he thinks the corrections department should hire him without requiring him to shave his beard.
Yeah, I believe nowhere the correction had given any indication that I need to shave off my beard or remove the turban. And at the same time, I find that I am very much qualified. I passed all exams, physical efficiency tests, the psychological, and each and every exam, which they've given me about 6-7 exams.
So you went through the whole process?
Yes. It took me more than a year to go through the process. They also had two things lined up for me. One was that I must pass the GED, which was one of the requirements, and I told them that the GED is a much lower level than the degree I'm holding of bachelor's degree in physics, chemistry, maths major. So, but still in about month's time, I passed and gave them the certificate. And then they came up saying that our requirement is that you should be a citizen. I also took citizenship and informed them. So having doing all these things, I feel that physically, mentally, and from the educational angle, I'm the right choice to join the correctional officer.
When did this start? When did you first apply?
In 2005.
And when did they tell you, no, you can't join because you need to shave off your beard?
Practically, they have not told me any time that I can't join. But after having completed all the medical and all the exams in the month of May 2006, they sent me for a gas mask test, which is you have to put on the mask. And there the facility told me, it's a private facility, they told me that unless I clean shave my beard, I cannot appear for this test. And at no stage they gave me any sort of mask to prove whether I failed the test or passed the test. They had never given me that test at all. So from that day onwards, from May 2006 onwards, I started talking to them. I was calling them and at the same time made a letter to them giving my all background, everything, that all these masks I have used in the Indian Navy when I was 26 years in the Indian Navy as a commander for underwater diving as well as firefighting and live fire or any other where we have to use these masks. I've used various types of masks.
Were you told that your beard made it difficult or even impossible for the gas mask to fit properly onto your face?
I was never told at any stage, because unless they have given me a fit mask test, they cannot themselves come to know whether the gas is going through the mask or not. So at no stage they have given me to wear a mask and carry out a test, which they should have done it.
So what has the CDCR told you about your status with them? Have they actually said to you, we're not going to hire you, and given a reason why?
They have not given me any reason, nor they have told me at any stage that they are not going to hire. It is only me who made a letter to them, made a letter to state personnel board and took up the matter because they were not giving me any reply, any answer.
So you have concluded that the issue is your beard, but you don't have an official document stating that.
No, I don't have any official document, but I feel after I was told that I should clean shave my beard for the mass test, I presume that this is the only reason. And under no circumstances I have to shave my beard for this particular job or any other job, because this is my religion and this is how I dress up, this is what I have been brought up, and I have kept my beard and my hair and using turban right from the time I am born. I have never cut my hair. I have to keep up the faith of my religion.
California's new attorney general has sided with the corrections department. How do you react to that?
Well, the last statement of her in the press conference, or my attorney told me that they are trying to dismiss my case, which is very, very upsetting and heartbreaking, that I have been waiting for the last 6 years to get justice from them. And if this is the state, I will be shattered. I will be very, very disappointed with the justice system in this country.
What is the status of your lawsuit? Because you have sued the state of California, have you not?
That's true. The verdict in my favor was given in November 2008. I practically won the case. And then CDCR was supposed to give me a job, for which they told me that I can apply for any other job, even outside the prison. I have applied for 5 jobs, sent them the application forms and everything, and they have not come up with any conclusion on that.
My guest is Triloshan Oberoi, who is an American, and he practices the Sikh religion. He has a beard, and he applied several years ago for a job as a guard working for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and he went through the process, but has not been hired, and it appears that it's because of his beard, which apparently, supposedly, conflicts with the wearing of a gas mask, and he has sued the state of California, but the CDCR has still not hired him, and California's Attorney General Kamala Harris is siding with the CDCR in this matter. But if the corrections department, can you think of a circumstance under which the corrections department could realistically ask you to shave off your beard? I mean, you don't agree that there's a necessary conflict between your beard and the gas mask, but can't the corrections department ultimately say, you know what, we need our people to be a certain way in order to do the job properly?
See, their own regulations, which was shown to the administrative judge during the discussion, their own regulation says that anybody who works as a correctional officer can keep up to 1-inch beard. He has to be permitted medically or some other grounds that he can't shave off. So if the gas or the poisonous gas or the tear gas leaks through 2 inches of beard, it will also leak from 1 inch of beard. When we say that it is clean shave, means 100% clean shave. There is no exemption for that. But if they have given accommodation to the people on medical grounds, they should give me also accommodation and try to use that gas mask on me. And moreover, if my beard or my hair are vulnerable to the inmates or anybody, then I personally feel that there should not be women in this as correctional officer, because their hair also, due to their hair, they are also vulnerable.
If they happen to have longer hair.
Yes, they have longer hair.
When I look at your beard now, it looks relatively close-shaven. What was the length of your beard when you went to see that company that was going to fit you for a gas mask?
Well, this is how I dress up. This is the same what it was 6 years back also. There is no difference. And I'm sure that I am not growing more beard, but on the contrary, I may be losing a little bit over a period of time. So the style of wearing the beard was exactly same what I am at present. And as it is, I have used and worked with those masks whole life, and I had no problem. There was no leakage of water, there was no leakage of smoke or any other contaminated.
Based on your experience in the Indian Armed Forces.
That's right.
What's the significance of the beard in the Sikh religion?
See, our gurus or our God has given us a uniform, that is wearing beard and turban. The Sikhism was created more than 300 years back, and our guru has given us a uniform. This was to save the weaker people, the women, the children, and Hindus from Muslims those days, those who are forcefully trying to convert other religions into the Muslim.
So you're required to wear the beard according to your religion?
Yes. We are never supposed to cut it. That's part of our uniform.
And what would that mean if you did cut it?
That means we are having faith in our religion and we are abiding to the rules of the religion.
Oh, no, my question was, what would it mean if you did cut the beard, if you did shave it off?
Then you are not a proper Sikh. Then you lost your religion.
Given that the Corrections Department hasn't moved on this matter, given that the Attorney General is siding, just recently we learned, is siding with the Corrections Department, at what point do you see yourself giving up, or do you not see yourself giving up this struggle?
I will never give up, and I will still fight for my right, which I deserve. I should get it.
In the meantime, have you been looking for other jobs?
Well, I've already got two jobs. In the mornings, I work for Folsom Cordova Unified School District. I teach in a school. And in the evenings, I work for Walmart. And I'm grateful to both of these organizations. They have not discriminated me against my religion.
So you stay pretty busy, it sounds like.
Absolutely. I work about 12 hours a day.
My goodness. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. Triloshan Oberoi, he is a man who follows the Sikh religion, and he is attempting to be employed by the California Corrections Department, but there's a problem because of his beard. The Corrections Department says that he needs to shave the beard off, apparently says he needs to shave the beard off so that it can fit a gas mask that he would be issued if he were hired. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And we invited the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to participate in this discussion or send us a written statement, but they declined because the subject is in litigation. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison.